Okay, it is November 6th. This is Bio 241. And we're going to start a new chapter today. And that is the endocrine system. Unless somebody has a question on the sensory system. Any questions on sensory system? But I think we polished that off last time. Okay? No questions? Fantastic. Okay, so I don't even think I want to review anything in sensory chapter. Let's just move right on to endocrine system. All right, well, what is, you know what we got to do? We got to define what a hormone is first. Hormone has a number of different characteristics. A hormone is a product that's secreted from a ductless gland. All right, so it is a, we could call it a substance or a chemical. Let's call it a chemical. Chemical secreted from an endocrine gland. And that's kind of a loaded term. You got to tell me what an endocrine gland is as opposed to an exocrine gland. What's the difference? Did anybody ever learn the difference between endocrine and exocrine gland? Maybe in anatomy someplace? Close. All right, well, I'm going to change the definition then. From a ductless gland. Which means what? It doesn't have any ducts. So that, a ductless gland, is an endocrine gland. And so what does that mean? Maybe you could figure out what a exocrine gland is. Yeah, it's one that has ducts. And could you give me an example, exocrine gland? Yeah, gland with ducts. Like for instance, sweat gland, salivary glands are exocrine glands.
What about an apocrine
gland? An apocrine gland is a special kind of...
Is that
different? No, it's an exocrine gland. It's just a special kind of exocrine gland. All right, so endocrine gland or ductless gland, so a hormone, chemical secreted from a ductless gland. All right. It is absorbed into the blood and travels to a target tissue. And elicits, that's a good thing, a specific response. Okay, so how does it get into the blood? What's a part of a blood vessel where it can get into and why? How do things get in and out of the blood? What part of a blood vessel?
A capillary.
Why only at a capillary?
Is that where the blood flows?
Well, blood flows through the heart.
Yeah.
It flows through arteries, flows through veins. But why does it get absorbed in a capillary?
Isn't that where it gathers all the nutrients?
This is true, but that doesn't explain to me why it can only go in a capillary. Because it is thin. Okay, so I think you're thinking the right thing. All right. Arteries are real thick, and things can only move in and out of the blood by diffusion. And so arteries are way too thick for diffusion. It's a barrier. Veins are way too thick. The only kind of vessel that is thin enough for exchange is a capillary.
Okay.
But this is true. This is true. So in the blood, so at a capillary, it's absorbed through a capillary by diffusion, and it travels everywhere that the blood goes. All over the body, and it goes to a target tissue. That's kind of a loaded term too. So a hormone won't affect every tissue in the body, only a target tissue. So a target tissue is special. And why is a target tissue special? It has to have something. It's got to have a receptor. So the hormone binds to a receptor. So target tissues have receptors to that particular chemical. And when that chemical binds to that receptor, it produces a specific response. It's going to change the metabolism inside the cell somehow. All right, so that's what a hormone is. It has to be picked up by the blood for distribution. Okay, that's what. So we're going to talk about glands that secrete hormones, just that way. And so here we have a number of endocrine glands on this slide. All right, so an endocrine gland are ductless glands that secrete hormones into the bloodstream. Hormones go to a target tissue that must contain a specific receptor protein. And sometimes we have compounds that are secreted by neurons that get picked up by the blood. And so in that particular case, we would call that a neurohormone. So sometimes it's hard to tell if something is a neurotransmitter or a hormone. It has components of both, so we just say, okay, throw up our hands and say, well, it's a neurohormone in that particular case instead of a what? Neurotransmitter. A good example of that would be norepinephrine. Okay, hormones affect metabolism of targets or target tissues or target cells. And don't forget, what does a target cell have to have? It's got to have some kind of receptor. So on the slide, we also see an illustration of where all of these endocrine glands are located. The hypothalamus is one. And the pituitary is one. Pineal gland is another one. These are in your central nervous system. The pituitary is pretty interesting because it's part brain tissue and part glandular tissue. Two different parts of your body make up the pituitary. And you can see where the pituitary is, right here underneath the brain, right smack in the middle. What bone is it surrounded by, mostly? What bone? What bone? What cranial bone? You're close. It almost sounded right. I almost can't hear in the back of the room. So in the very front, you've got... Well, that's the frontal bone, but right behind the frontal bone is the ethmoid. And behind the ethmoid is the bone that goes all the way across.
Oh, that's
okay, it's the sella turcica. That's the part in the sphenoid bone where the pituitary is. Okay? So there is a depression in the sphenoid bone called the sella turcica, and that's where the pituitary is. It's right above, really, the roof of your mouth, so it's actually pretty easy to get to if it needs to be surgerized. Okay, so here it is. Another endocrine gland, thyroid gland. We also have adrenal glands above the kidney, and the pancreas is an endocrine gland. But you're going to see it also has other kinds of functions as well. Ovaries and the testes are endocrine glands. So that pretty much wraps up most of the important ones. So here is a table. I'm not going to go over this right now, but later on after we look through the whole chapter, you can use this as a little study guide to review the different hormones, what the effect is. Okay, so let's classify some hormones. We see different classes. Some are amine hormones, some are polypeptide hormones, some are glycoproteins, some are steroids. And you should have a feel for what the action of some of these different hormones are by their basic physical chemistry. So for instance, a steroid hormone, what's a basic physical chemistry principle of a steroid hormone? What kind of compound is it? It's a lipid molecule. That's right. So can it go through the membrane or not through the cell membrane? Yes. I like that answer. It can go through the cell membrane because the cell membrane is what? It's a phospholipid bilayer. So lipid molecules can actually diffuse through the cell membrane. A glycoprotein. Anybody know what a glycoprotein is? It's a protein that's been modified somehow. What does glyco mean? Sugar. So it's a sugar protein, right? It's a protein with a being modified by a sugar molecule. Polypeptides are just soluble proteins. And of course, don't forget, you can look at some examples right here for glycoproteins, LH, FSH, and TSH. I'll tell you what those are in a second. Polypeptide hormones, antidiuretic hormone, growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, glucagon. Insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. Adrenal corticotropic hormone and parathyroid hormone are all polypeptide hormones. These are hydrophilic kinds of hormones. So can they get into the cell? No. So where do they have to bind to a receptor if they can't get into the cell? on the cell membrane. That's right. There's got to be a receptor on the outside of the cell for them to elicit any kind of response. The same thing for amine hormones. They're derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. These include things that you're familiar with already, like norepinephrine. But you might say, wait, norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter. How can it be a hormone too? Because of the adrenal medulla, for instance, when it releases norepinephrine into the blood. Okay? Because the chromaffin cells inside the adrenal medulla act like the postganglionic fiber of a sympathetic pathway. Okay, epinephrine from the adrenal medulla again, and thyroxine and melatonin from the thyroid and from the pineal gland. All right, so here are some, and a couple of good examples of steroid hormones. These aren't all of them, but here's a couple good ones. They're all derived from cholesterol. That's testosterone, male sex hormone, estrogen, progesterone, female sex hormones, and cortisol. Neither male or female. We all have these from the adrenal cortex. That's a glucocorticoid. So you might understand or surmise that it's going to have effect on glucose metabolism. One of the effects will be on glucose metabolism. Another kind of steroid is called aldosterone. That's not on the slide. That's a mineralocorticoid. That's going to have effect on mineral metabolism in your body, like for sodium and potassium. It's going to affect sodium and potassium in your body. So here is a flowchart of how your body converts cholesterol, a precursor molecule, into a number of important hormones. Cholesterol is modified by just changing this chain on the top of the molecule, and we call that pregnenolone. Pregnenolone then can be converted immediately into progesterone just by taking off that one little hydrogen atom right there. This is progesterone. And progesterone is an important regulatory sex hormone in females, but not in males. I don't know of any effect progesterone has in the male, but if anybody wants to do a Google search and let me know, there might be something. I'm just not familiar with it. Progesterone comes from the corpus luteum after an egg has been ovulated from a mature follicle in an ovary. Then this corpus luteum starts to secrete progesterone. Progesterone in different tissues, right, can be converted into androstenedione. That's a precursor to testosterone. And testosterone is secreted by primarily the testes. It's a male, produces male secondary sex characteristics. It also supports spermatogenesis in the male. And androgens are also secreted by the adrenal cortex right here. Okay, so androstenedione is also produced by the adrenal cortex, both in males and females. And in the adrenal cortex, progesterone is converted into cortisol. That's hydrocortisone. And then finally, in the female, testosterone in an ovary is converted to estrogen. And that's secreted by these developing follicles right here to help control the ovulatory cycle in women. All right, but women don't secrete testosterone from the ovary. It just is immediately converted. This is just a metabolic pathway. Okay, let's talk about some chemical classification of hormones still. Steroid and thyroid hormones are lipids. They can diffuse into target tissues because they can diffuse through the phospholipid bilayer. The two major thyroid hormones are tetraiodothreonine. So here is threonine that has been iodinated four times. So we call that T4 sometimes. The short word for that is just T4. The active form is actually triiodothreonine, and that's called T3. Then the thyroid gland produces both of these hormones. Some hormones, actually most hormones, are produced in a prohormone or precursor state. So how do you know this is a precursor and inactive molecule? Okay, I haven't mentioned that yet, I guess. Okay, for instance, there are two ways you can tell. First way is by the prefix that's used. The second way sometimes is by the suffix that's used on a word. So what is a prefix? It's just the beginning part of a word, and the suffix is the end part of the word. So if you see for instance, protein, it's a bad example, protein, All right, and if there's a pro in the beginning of it, see, that's a bad one because there's pro, yeah, I'm going to use something else. Okay. Okay. For instance, there is an enzyme that produces coagulation or produces that stops you from bleeding. Okay, and that's called thrombin. And it is produced in an inactive form called prothrombin. So we know that you have lots of thrombin in your blood, but it's not producing blood clots in your person right now, because what would happen to you if prothrombin was making... Well, yeah, you would just die immediately, right, because your blood wouldn't flow through your system. So your body makes a lot of thrombin, but it in an inactive form. So it's prothrombin, but it can be activated into an active form by just chopping off a little bit of this molecule, okay, and then it becomes thrombin, and very quickly can stop blood loss at the site of whatever that vascular injury is. So prothrombin is what, active or inactive?
Inactive.
Right. Okay, there could be something else too. There could be another kind of enzyme. Enzyme, and let's just say Ogen. Enzymogen. There's no such word. But there are plenty of enzymes that are produced in this form Ogen, and what can you tell me about it? Active or inactive? It's actually inactive. It is inactive as well. And it can become activated, again, at a moment's notice. Because if your body was going to have to produce these proteins in large quantities before you bleed to death, it wouldn't have time. It might take 2 weeks to get your blood titer up to where you have good blood clotting function. Okay? So your body produces it and stores it in the reservoir in your blood and then activates whatever small quantities it needs at just a moment's notice. A good example of this thing right here would be, for instance, and it's in this particular case, it's going to be a hormone, angiotensinogen. Angiotensinogen is inactive. And it can become activated by just modifying the molecule a little bit by some enzyme. It becomes what? Angiotensin. Very quickly. So again, when you see that Ogen, it's inactive. Whenever you see that pro, it's inactive. So when you see pro-hormone, like pro-insulin, that just means what? Almost ready to go to work, but it's inactive. It's got to be converted into an active form. Okay. And this, definitely that's the case for a lot of enzymes. And as a matter of fact, some hormones are actually produced in a pre-pro-hormone state, where they're even precursors to pro-hormones. Like pre-proinsulin. So your body is real serious about making insulin. So now it's got two backup sources for it. It's got proinsulin as well as pre-proinsulin. So your body should never ever run out of insulin under normal circumstances. All right. And as a matter of fact, some hormones are inactive until they're activated by the target cells themselves. A good example of that would be thyroxine. The kind, most of the type that's floating in your blood is T4. T4 does not have much activity, right? And T4 is absorbed by cells, and cells then convert it into triiodothreonine, and triiodothreonine is the active component of thyroid hormone that produces a response in target cells. So that's the form that binds to the receptor, the T3. Okay. So both the nervous system and the endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. What is the name of chemicals used by the nervous system to communicate? Strictly nervous system would be? Yeah, it would work at the synapse. What do you call the chemical at the synapse? That allows, yeah, neurotransmitter. Use a neurotransmitter at a synapse to communicate between the presynaptic, postsynaptic cell. All right, and the endocrine system uses chemicals as well. And what do we call those chemicals? Hormones. Right. Okay. There are sometimes there are differences between neurotransmitters and hormones, or the big difference is that hormones are transported in the blood. And hormones have a greater diversity of effects in the target tissues than neurotransmitters. Typically, neurotransmitters are going to produce EPSPs and IPSPs, and that's it. But hormones are going to produce all kinds of different ranges of effects, and we're going to see some effects in a couple slides coming up, right? But the target tissues for both neurotransmitters and hormones have to have what? A receptor. And the receptor, the shape of that receptor has to be complementary to the shape of either the neurotransmitter or the hormone. And there has to be a way to inactivate both the neurotransmitters and the hormone, because once you secrete a neurotransmitter or a hormone, you don't want to live for the rest of your life with that signal, right? It should be just a transient signal so that you could move on to the next event. Okay. A tissue usually responds to a number of different hormones. So that means what in terms of receptors? There've got to be different kinds of receptors on the in that cell for different hormones. Otherwise, it won't see any effect. Two hormones are synergistic if they work together to produce the same effect, just like muscles, right? If there are two muscles that when they contract produce the same motion, those are synergistic muscles. And in terms of hormones, when we use this word synergy, for instance, if we have two hormones, A and B, and if hormone A by itself produces a response of 2, and hormone B produces a response of 2 by itself, if we put A plus B together at the same time, synergy means that the response is not going to be 4. It's going to be what? Just as an example, might be 10. Right? It's going to be much greater than the sum of the responses of each hormone individually. Okay? So that's what synergism is. And if you want an example of that, I could give you an example later. But you might have to take a pharmacology class to understand how that works. Once you see an example, you'll say, oh yeah, okay, that's obvious how that works. Okay. Some hormones have a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of the target organ to a second hormone. So maybe even the first hormone doesn't have any effect whatsoever, but the second hormone will only have an effect if the first hormone is present as well. So you need to, a receptor needs to be stimulated with two hormones. And can you think of a receptor that actually needs two ligands in order to become activated? We already looked at one.
No.
Muscle? Muscarinic receptor? That usually needs one acetylcholine, but you're really close. You're really close. It's the nicotinic, yeah, the nicotinic sodium channel, right, requires two acetylcholines before it goes through a conformation change. So this shouldn't be too strange of an effect, the circumstance for you to see. Okay. And then sometimes hormones will affect each other by inhibition. And when that's the case, we call those two hormones antagonistic to each other, right? Just like muscle action, produce opposite effects. All right, the way that, so we said that these hormones are, and neurotransmitters are degraded very rapidly in the body. And we say that the lifetime is characterized of that particular hormone. We call it a half-life. This is the time required for blood levels to be reduced by half. That's what we call the half-life. So that's just an exponential decrease. All right, so if we look at concentration over time, the way hormones are degraded, it looks something like that. Okay, so the time that it takes to go from where it was up over here, 100% to 50%, that's this time. What is that time? Right here. So whatever period of time this is. And if you go another half time, then it goes down in half once again, and then half once again. So this is what we call the half-life of that particular compound. And you see that it might not ever really go away altogether, but every half-life, it decreases its activity in half. Okay. So that's what we mean by half-life. And half-life of some hormones range from minutes to hours for most. But for the thyroid hormones, the half-life is days, so it has a very long persistence. Normal tissue responses are produced only when hormones are in the physiologic range, whatever the body is set up to do, and that's partially due to the number of receptors that are in the target tissue. Higher than normal doses of a hormone, when people take exogenous hormones for some reason, right, we call that a pharmacologic dose, can cause a number of strange side effects that don't happen under normal circumstances. And we presume that's the case because a hormone that normally binds to one receptor, when it's in really high concentration, might bind to other receptors that are in that target tissue as well, okay, producing some of these side effects. So that's probably due to binding to receptors of other hormones. There is something called a priming effect. We call this upregulation. This increases the sensitivity of the target tissue to a particular hormone, and it occurs when a hormone induces more of its own receptors in a target cell. So since the target cell has more receptors, right, it doesn't reach saturation at the same level as before, and it just produces a greater response. So that produces a greater response in a target cell. Target cells, on the other hand, some of them can be desensitized. We call that downregulation. This occurs after long exposure to high levels of, in particular, polypeptide hormones. And in this particular case, what receptors are taken out of the membrane. So now, at the same level of hormone, it produces less of a response in the target tissue. So subsequent exposure to this hormone produces a lesser response due to a decreased number of receptors in the target tissue membranes. And most peptide hormones in your body are released in a pulsatile secretion fashion, and that's what helps prevent downregulation in normal tissues. Because if a hormone is secreted at a high level over a long period of time, what's going to happen to the sensitivity of that target tissue? It's going to decrease, and then the hormone won't be able to elicit that response anymore. So under normal circumstances, the endocrine gland will release a little pulse of hormone and then stop. Release another pulse of hormone and then stop. And then that prevents the downregulation or desensitization to that particular hormone. All right, so target tissues show specificity. What the heck does that mean? Specificity. We talked about that already in terms of enzyme and receptors before. So remember, a hormone has to bind to a receptor. And how do you explain binding of a hormone to a receptor, just like a substrate to an enzyme? What do you use? What kind of model in your mind do you use? Lock and key model, perfect example, right? So the hormone molecule has to have the correct shape to fit into the shape of the receptor site on that receptor, or the active site on a receptor. So that's specificity. And if you change the molecule's shape a little bit, it can't fit into the receptor site anymore. And when it can't bind, then that's not going to produce a response. So it's highly specific. It also shows high affinity. So very low concentrations of hormone will be able to produce a large response inside the cell. And low capacity. So that means because it's high affinity, the cells don't have to have a lot of receptors. And so those receptors that it does have, right, saturate very quickly, even at very low levels of hormone concentration. So you don't have very high levels of hormones in our body. They are very low levels because of the high affinity for receptors for that particular hormone. Lipophilic hormones. Okay, what kind of a hormone is a lipophilic? Dissolve in water or not in water? Doesn't like to dissolve in water very much, but what can you tell me about a lipid substance? Can it diffuse into a cell by itself? Yeah, because it can diffuse through the phospholipid bilayer. So lipophilic hormones have receptors in the target cytoplasm because the hormone can diffuse right inside the cell. Right? Or they can be receptors in the nucleus because the hormone can diffuse into the nucleus as well, can diffuse right through the cell membrane and nuclear envelope. Their target is the nucleus, right? If it's a lipophilic hormone, the target in any case is going to be the nucleus where they affect transcription. What is transcription? What the heck is transcription? Oh, think way back, transcription. What's the component part to it? Yeah, it's the conversion of information in DNA into information in RNA. So that's the first step of protein synthesis, right? That's the first step of protein synthesis. What's the second step called? Translation. That's using information in messenger RNA and converting it into information in the primary sequence of a protein. Okay. So when a hormone affects the nucleus by activating certain genes and causing transcription to take place, we call that the genomic action of a hormone because it's affecting the genes inside the nucleus. All right, and a gene is just a part on a DNA molecule that defines what kind of protein that should be made. That's what a gene is. But genomic action is relatively slow. It takes a long time for cells to produce a protein, maybe 30 minutes or longer. All right, so this kind of action is relatively slow. Receptors for water-soluble hormones, on the other hand, can't be in the cytoplasm, can't be in the nucleus because those hormones never get in there. They have to be on the surface of the target cell. And when they bind to the receptors on the surface of the target cell, they act through second messengers inside the cell. And when you have that second messenger system, remember that it's usually a cascade. It usually uses G proteins with a number of different steps, and each step has a level of amplification. So this kind of signal transduction across the membrane when a hormone binds to a water-soluble receptor, it is fast, and there is a large amplification in the signal. So these effects are quick. Right? And then there's a couple, yeah.
And it's a kinase?
Oh, you know what? It could act through kinases. Yeah, it could act through protein kinases. I have a couple examples coming up. Okay, it could act through calcium. A second messenger could be cyclic AMP. For instance, and cyclic AMP could activate some protein kinases. Or when a hormone binds to a receptor on the cell surface, it might induce the release of calcium from smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which then binds to calmodulin, which activates protein kinases, but eventually it's going to activate or inactivate a protein kinase somewhere. Okay. Some steroids can also act on cell surface receptors. In that particular case, it's not going to act on the genome, but it's going to act through some kind of second messenger. We call that the non-genomic action of this particular steroid hormone. Okay, but in most cases, steroid hormones go into the cell, the cytoplasmic or nuclear receptors. So you might be wondering, well, how on earth does this all happen? So you have a lipid hormone. It travels in the blood. Well, how can something that's lipid dissolve in water? Because what's a major component of water? Have we talked about blood in here yet? I don't think so. No? Okay, blood has two main components to it. It's got the cellular part, which we call formed elements, and it's got plasma. Plasma is by far the biggest part, and the biggest part of plasma is, take a guess, is water. Yeah. So here you have a lipid hormone that's trying to dissolve in water. How likely is that? Is that highly likely or kind of unlikely? It's unlikely, right? So in order for lipid hormones to dissolve in water, they have to combine with something. They have to combine with a protein. So here is a carrier protein. Part of this protein is lipophilic, so it will bind a lipid hormone. And this outer part of this protein is hydrophilic. It likes to dissolve in water. So it's acting like what? Kind of like a detergent or a soap or something that can carry this hormone in the blood. So this increases the solubility of a hormone in the plasma. All right, but this hormone can dissociate from the carrier protein, so it's always in equilibrium. Most of it is in the carrier protein, but if there's none in the blood, then some of this hormone will disassociate and dissolve in the blood. And the best way to think of that is, I think, due to Le Chatelier's principle. When you had a chemical reaction, right, if you had a chemical reaction, A plus B going to C plus D, right here, what happens to A and B if we take some C away? It's going to go to the right to fill some C up again, right? So the same thing happens here. If we take some of this hormone out of the plasma, it's going to cause dissociation of the carrier protein hormone complex so that a little bit of hormone will find its way into the plasma. Or if we put a lot of hormone in the plasma, what's going to happen? If you have excess carrier protein floating around that isn't bound to a hormone, hormone is going to bind to the carrier protein. Okay, so this is always going to be in equilibrium. There's another equilibrium, and that's between the water that is in the plasma and water that's in the cytoplasm. So this is always in equilibrium as well. As a matter of fact, this is just driven by the concentration gradient. So if we take away all this hormone on the inside of the cell, that's going to drive the hormone that's in the plasma into the cell. Okay. And can this hormone go across the plasma membrane right here?
Yeah,
because it's what? It's a lipophilic molecule. Once it's in the cytoplasm, it binds to a receptor protein. Okay, so there is a receptor protein. And the receptor protein, so now this hormone is taken out of the cytoplasm, which what? Draws more hormone into the cell that causes more dissociation from the carrier protein. And this hormone now is free to move in or translocate into the nucleus. And this unit is what we call a nuclear hormone receptor with the hormone will bind to DNA, and that's going to stimulate the transcription of this gene producing messenger RNA, which then will leave the nucleus that will then be used for protein synthesis, and that's going to produce the steroid hormone response inside the cell. Okay, whatever that response of whatever these proteins are going to do inside the cell, that's what we call the response inside the cell. So nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors when bound to hormone ligands. So this receptor protein can't bind to the DNA to cause transcription. It only can when it binds the hormone, right? It's got to be a complete receptor protein bound to a hormone. That activates transcription. All right, so this constitutes a superfamily composed of steroid family hormones and also thyroid hormones, and that also includes vitamin D and retinoic acid. I'll show you an example of what the effect of retinoic acid is in just a second. Okay, so there are nuclear hormone receptors, right? So here is a nuclear hormone receptor. It's got two main domains to it. There's one domain that binds to the DNA, and another domain that binds to the steroid hormone. All right, so here's the ligand binding domain, the DNA binding domain. And we call this the receptor protein for steroid hormone. And this is where it eventually is going to bind on a DNA molecule. This is upstream from a gene. So here is the gene. This is the thing that's going to be transcribed. But before transcription can occur, right, these sites have to be occupied by this receptor protein and steroid hormone. So this thing right here is what we call a hormone response element, or an HRE. Sometimes maybe it's called an HRU, or hormone response unit. But notice that it has two sites. We call these half sites. It has to bind to receptor proteins in order for it to act as a competent transcription factor. So not just one, but two. So here you have two steroid hormones bound to two receptor proteins. They occupy the sites, and when these sites are occupied, that allows transcription of this gene, right, producing messenger RNA, which then will produce a protein through translation once this messenger RNA reaches the cytoplasm. Right, either rough endoplasmic reticulum or smooth endoplasmic reticulum. No, a free ribosome or rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so this is the HRE right here bound to two receptor proteins, and we call that dimerization of a receptor because you need two of them in order to activate this gene. Okay, you know what? I've talked about this slide already. Right, the two ligand-bound receptors have to bind to each HRE because it contains, what, two half-sites. And when that does, that produces, or that acts as a transcription factor. All right, so thyroid secretes about 90% thyroxine and 10% triiodothreonine. 99.9% of the hormones in the blood, okay, and that is T4, it's bound to that protein in the blood that allows T4 to dissolve in plasma. We call that the thyroid binding globulin. So thyroxine is carried in the blood by thyroid binding globulin. And globulin just means that it's a protein. Right, but only the free thyroid can enter cells. So the bound is a reservoir. But don't forget, it's always in equilibrium with the unbound, which is what, 0.04% that's in the plasma. T4 can enter the cell, and then it's immediately converted into T3. T3 binds to receptor protein, which then, well, that is located inside the nucleus. So the binding site for T3 is inside the nucleus. It's a nuclear receptor. It's not a cytoplasmic receptor. Okay, so here, in order to express the effects of triiodothreonine, what do we have? We have some receptor proteins for T3, and that's going to bind to one half of a hormone response element. And the other receptor unit is not for triiodothreonine, it is for retinoic acid. So in order for thyroid hormone to have an effect, there also has to be retinoic acid available, which is permitting the effect of triiodothreonine. All right, so this explains how there are permissive effects of hormones acting as transcription factors. So this dimerization right here is not a homodimer. We call this a heterodimer because it requires two different kinds of units to bind to the hormone response element before transcription can take place. Okay, so water-soluble hormones use cell surface receptors because, of course, they can't pass through the plasma membrane. And these actions are mediated by second messengers inside the cells. And I think for one of the tests you learned a couple second messengers. We're going to see a couple more. The hormone is the first messenger, which means it is extracellular. The second messenger then carries a signal or transduces the signal from the receptor to inside the cell where it's going to have some kind of response. Okay, so let's look at this scheme right here. So adenylate cyclase mediates the effects of many polypeptide and glycoprotein hormones. All right, so a hormone binds, where's my pointer? Okay, let me try over here. Okay, so a hormone binds to a receptor. So here's the G protein coupled receptor. And when the hormone binds, it causes dissociation. This alpha subunit then is free to float around inside the membrane. And it bumps into adenylate cyclase, which then converts ATP into cyclic AMP. That's a special form of cyclic AMP. And these two phosphates then are released into the cytoplasm. Cyclic AMP can bind to an inhibitory subunit, which is attached to a protein kinase. So don't forget, what does a protein kinase do again? It can phosphorylate proteins, maybe activating them or inactivating them. So when cyclic AMP is available, right, then this protein kinase becomes active. And the inhibitory subunit is bound to cyclic AMP. Okay, and so then that will phosphorylate proteins that might activate certain metabolic pathways, or on the other hand, it could inactivate certain metabolic pathways. All right, so cyclic AMP in this case is what we call the second messenger as a result of adenylate cyclase in the membrane. All right, so when one hormone molecule binds to this G protein coupled receptor and the alpha subunit binds to adenylate cyclase, that can amplify that one signaling molecule hormone, what, thousands of times. That can produce thousands of cyclic AMPs, right, which then activate thousands of protein kinases, which then each protein kinase can activate, what, thousands of other enzymes inside the cell. So that's a cascade. So that can operate very quickly because of these different steps of amplification. Okay. Now, how can we get rid of cyclic AMP? I don't think I have a slide of this. Oh, yeah, I do. Okay. What kind of compound? This is a review from the census chapter even. What kind of enzyme deactivates cyclic AMP? And it is normally active in a lot of cells. I think you said it. Okay, it's called phosphodiesterase. And we saw phosphodiesterase in rod cells. Okay, that phosphodiesterase becomes activated when light is shined onto a rod cell. That activates phosphodiesterase. That gets rid of cyclic GMP, which closes the sodium channel, which shuts off that dark current, right, which then eventually stimulates a bipolar cell. You might need to go back and look at that particular slide. But anyway, a phosphodiesterase is always active in most cells, right, and so is going to start to degrade cyclic AMP, which means what? Then this inhibitory subunit is going to bind to this protein kinase, inactivating it, and so that's going to terminate the effects of this hormone that's bound to this receptor right here. Okay. So cyclic AMP is inactivated by phosphodiesterase. But if you have a lot of hormone, right, that can overcome the breakdown of cyclic AMP by the phosphodiesterase that's in the cell. So there's always a balance between how much cyclic AMP is being produced by the action of this hormone compared to how much is being broken down by the phosphodiesterase inside the cell. Okay, there's another system, and this is called the phospholipase C mechanism. It also produces a second messenger. So we have a hormone binding to a receptor, which activates G proteins, which then float through the membrane to bump into another enzyme. This is phospholipase C. And it will activate phospholipase. So what's the substrate for phospholipase? How do you know that's an enzyme, as a matter of fact? How do you know that's an enzyme? Well, because there's an ASE on the end of the word. And so what's the substrate for phospholipase? Phospho what? You're close. Phospholipid. Now, that seems to be difficult. Where are you going to find phospholipids? In the membrane. There's plenty of phospholipids in the membrane, right? So I think this is really interesting because you learn that the membrane is what? A structure. But the membrane actually also acts as a precursor to second messengers that end up inside the cell. It's a necessary precursor for this particular transduction scheme. So phospholipase then can break down phospholipids in the membrane and produce a similar kind of chemical called inositol 3-phosphate. But we'll just call it IPI3 for short. Okay, IPI3. IPI3 diffuses into the cytoplasm and will bind to smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And one of the jobs of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is because it has calcium pumps. It's always pumping calcium from the cytosol into the endoplasmic reticulum. Right? When IPI3 binds to smooth endoplasmic reticulum, it releases calcium into the cytoplasm. And that calcium then can have some effect inside the cell. Okay? Phospholipase C will also activate another second messenger called diacyl glyceride, or DAG. I don't know if we're going to talk much about that. But anyway, when calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm, it binds to a molecule that we looked at already, that's calmodulin. It binds to this protein, and calcium calmodulin can activate protein kinases as well, which then phosphorylates enzymes that can activate enzymes that will turn on some kind of biochemical pathway producing an effect inside the cell. So this can act like a switch to turn on or turn off metabolism inside the cell. So let's look at a specific example using both of these different second messenger systems. Okay, so epinephrine, okay, who can tell me something about epinephrine? Where does it come from? A room, a little bit louder? Adrenal medulla, yeah. So it's not really a neurotransmitter in this particular case. It's going to be a hormone secreted by the adrenal medulla, carried everywhere in the body via the circulatory system. And it's going to go to the liver. And there are receptors for epinephrine. There are beta adrenergic receptors and alpha adrenergic receptors. These are different receptors, but epinephrine is going to bind to them. Let's look at the beta adrenergic first. It's a G protein coupled receptor. That the subunits of those G proteins are going to activate adenylate cyclase. What's adenylate cyclase going to do? It's going to convert ATP into cyclic AMP. That's the second messenger. Cyclic AMP is going to activate a protein kinase, and this protein kinase is going to go to glycogen, and it's going to phosphorylate a glucose. Okay, it's going to use another ATP. But what do we call this process of going from glycogen to glucose? Ah, you thought you could forget that one. but it should come back. It's way back in the back of your mind somewhere. That's glycogenolysis. Okay, glycogenolysis, breaking glycogen down, right? And the liver cell is kind of special because it can convert glucose 1-phosphate to glucose 6-phosphate, and it can actually chop off this phosphate to produce glucose inside the cell, and then glucose can leave the cell and go into the blood. So here's an example of epinephrine having an effect on blood glucose levels. It's going to do what? It's going to increase blood glucose levels by changing this metabolic pathway, right? It's going to change the balance of glycogenesis into glycogenolysis, thereby bringing blood glucose concentration up or raising blood glucose concentration. Do you think that's important? Is it important to regulate blood glucose? Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this is a real important mechanism to be aware of here. It's so important that there's a backup system. Right, epinephrine can also bind to alpha-adrenergic receptors, which increase cytosolic calcium, which bind to calmodulin, which activate a different set of protein kinases, which still also stimulates glycogenolysis. Right, so both of these systems eventually are going to increase blood glucose. All right, so that's epinephrine. Increasing blood glucose. And I think you've had an endocrine lab already. You looked at insulin, right? Sort of. Did you do a blood glucose? Did you drink the glucose solution?
No.
Not yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, we're not going to do
that. You're not going to do that one?
No.
Oh, you could have if you wanted to.
No. No lunch, no breakfast.
Right. And then pass out right away. Okay. Well, let's just quickly review, though, that lab anyway, because you at least did a dry lab of it. So there are two hormones. There's one that increases blood glucose, and there's one that decreases blood glucose. They come from the pancreas. Which one decreases blood glucose? Insulin decreases blood glucose. And which one from the pancreas increases? It's called, glucagon. Glucagon increases blood glucose. So this epinephrine here, is it acting like insulin or glucagon? It acts like glucagon. As a matter of fact, there are a number of hormones in our body that increase blood glucose. Glucagon is one, epinephrine is another. And the only one that lowers blood glucose is insulin. That could probably partly explain why, that could explain diabetes mellitus, which is what? Mostly characterized by elevated blood glucose levels. Because most hormones do what? Elevate blood glucose, not decrease. You only have one that decreases it, and that's insulin. Okay, so here are two pathways that increase blood glucose just by binding of epinephrine to alpha-adrenergic or beta-adrenergic receptors on a liver cell. One acts through calmodulin, the other works through cyclic AMP. So that's a pretty nice specific example of how metabolism can be changed inside the cell. So what can you tell me about epinephrine? Is it lipophilic or hydrophilic? Lipophilic or hydrophilic? For epinephrine. Because where is it binding? Receptors. Here. It's on the surface of the cell, so it can't be lipophilic. Well, I suppose there's a couple of strange examples that are lipophilic. But anyway, it's a hydrophilic because it can't get inside the cell. Okay. Well, since we started to talk about blood glucose a little bit, here is insulin. Okay, so you just told me that insulin decreases blood glucose and glucagon increases blood glucose. So what's their effect? They're antagonistic to each other. That's right. But is that a good thing or is that like totally confusing? That's a good thing, right? Because that gives you precise control under normal conditions of blood glucose, which is what you want to have. Okay. Tyrosine kinase is the receptor for insulin. So it's used by insulin and many other growth factors to cause cellular effects inside the cell. So let's look at the tyrosine kinase receptor. It's a surface receptor. So that means it's going to bind hydrophilic molecules that can't get inside the cytoplasm. And it also consists of two units. And so here are the two subunits that are transmembrane proteins. And when insulin is present, it binds to the active site, these two subunits come together and they become activated. We call this step dimerization. So insulin has to bind to these two tyrosine kinase enzymes. It's actually a receptor enzyme, right? Because it's binding insulin and it's going to be an enzyme as well. Right, but it's not an enzyme until the dimerization step takes place. All right, so what happens is then this tyrosine kinase is phosphorylated, and once it is phosphorylated, right, it can phosphorylate tyrosine. And tyrosine is just an amino acid that is used to make up various kinds of proteins, right? It's one of the building blocks of a protein. And if it's in the right spot in that protein, then this tyrosine kinase can phosphorylate it. And when it's phosphorylated, it will change the activity of that particular protein. Right? So it will phosphorylate signaling molecules, produce a cascade of effects, and one of the cascades of this effect right here is glucose uptake and also anabolic reactions. What's an anabolic reaction again? It is anabolic is putting together, right? Small molecules making big molecules. Okay. All right, so how does this happen? As a matter of fact, okay, so here we have insulin. Can glucose get inside the cell without insulin? And at this point in the class, you should say no. Glucose can't get inside the cell unless there is this passport. Insulin is the passport that allows cells to take up glucose. And when cells take up glucose, what happens to blood glucose concentration? Yeah, because it goes from the blood into the cell. If there's no insulin and you have glucose in the blood and it can't get into the cell, where's it have to stay? It's got to stay in the blood, and you're going to have high glucose concentration even though you're in a fasted state. Even for days you're going to have elevated glucose because glucose can't go anywhere once it's in the blood. And it's going to produce a lot of nasty effects because it can't go anywhere. Plus, if the cells don't get glucose, what's happening to the cells? Well, they're starving to death even though glucose is right on the other side of the plasma membrane, right? So it's really kind of a terrible condition to have. So how is it that insulin can act as a passport to allow glucose to enter the cell? And as a matter of fact, why can't glucose enter the cell? Because have you ever taken glucose or a sugar cube and put it in coffee or tea or something? What happens to it? It dissolves right away. So it is what? Hydrophilic. It's a very hydrophilic molecule, can't get through the cell membrane because of the phospholipid bilayer. Can't get in there. All right, so it needs help. So what is a way, if glucose is high on the outside of the cell and low on the inside, does it want to move in? Yeah, just by diffusion. But it can't. So in that particular condition, right, what do we need to do to the membrane in order to get it to go inside the cell? Okay, it just needs some kind of carrier protein. We call that facilitated diffusion. It doesn't need to be pumped in. It's still going from high concentration to low. It's still passive. So facilitated diffusion is passive, but it just allows a pathway for that hydrophilic molecule to get through the cell membrane. It's called facilitated diffusion. Okay, it's just a special case of diffusion that allows hydrophilic molecules to move through the cell membrane. Okay. And that transporter protein is called GLUT4. And GLUT4 is activated when this tyrosine kinase is activated. And this took a long time to figure this system out right here. All right, so the action of insulin. Don't forget, insulin is the passport that allows glucose to do what? Enter the cell. Let's look and see how maybe that happens. Okay, the normal cell at rest is producing these vesicles right here, these circular structures inside the cytoplasm. And these vesicles, we didn't really learn the name. I think I mentioned it because I wanted you to become a little familiar with it. A vesicle inside the cell could be what? A lysosome for digestion, could be a peroxisome for detoxification, for instance, could be a secretory vesicle. But this one has got a special name. It's called an endosome. Endosome. And you can see that it has some special things. It's not just a phospholipid bilayer. It's got some special things inserted into the membrane of this vesicle, and these are what we call the GLUT4, standing for glucose transporter. Number 4 is probably the fourth one that somebody ever discovered, and it seems to be the most prevalent one. Okay, the glucose transporters are in these endosomes, but they're inside the cell. So if this carrier for glucose is inside the cell, then it doesn't allow glucose to enter the cell, right, because it's inside the cell. Well, what does a cell do when it gets the proper signal from insulin? Right, the tyrosine kinase is activated. It phosphorylates a number of enzymes inside the cell and signaling molecules, which then move these endosomes over to the cell membrane. And when the endosomes reach the cell membrane, they fuse to the cell membrane, and these GLUT4 transporters now are incorporated into the plasma membrane of the cell. And what are these GLUT4 transporters? What's the function of these GLUT4 transporters? They allow the translocation of glucose from outside the cell to the inside, passively. Right, so these things just kind of act like teeter-totters. When a glucose binds to this active site, then this site over here closes, and this site over here opens up, and glucose then diffuses into the cell. And when glucose dissociates from this active site, then this one closes, and this side opens up, and it's ready to transport another glucose down its concentration gradient. So it's not a pump, it's just a facilitated diffusion carrier. All right, so you have these GLUT4 transporters in a reservoir inside these cells, and they get inserted into the plasma membrane very rapidly whenever there is an insulin signal. Okay, there is another competing process that is always recovering plasma membrane and putting it into endosomes. And when that happens, right, then it takes out these GLUT4 transporters and puts it back into the reservoir. Right, so it all depends on what the balance of the signal is. If there's a large insulin signal, then the process that wins out is what? The insertion of endosomes into the plasma membrane. But when the insulin signal goes away, the process that wins out is what? The recovery of these glucose transporters back into these endosomes over here. So don't forget this plasma membrane is what the best way to think of the plasma membrane is not just a phospholipid bilayer, but what a fluid mosaic model. This membrane is very fluid. You can pinch part of it off, right, and put it inside the cell. You can then capture the mosaic proteins that are in the membrane, and then they won't have any activity. Or you could put this endosome into the membrane, and then this membrane has conferred the activity of these proteins that are embedded in the endosome membrane. The beauty of this system here is that if for glucose uptake, you might need thousands and thousands of these GLUT4 transporters in a cell. And if you had to build a GLUT4 transporter starting with transcription, it would take you what? Hours, maybe days, maybe even a week to get the proper level in the cell membrane for this cell to take glucose up. But what range of time does glucose change in your body? Does it change month to month, week to week, or what? It changes hour to hour depending on your diet and physical activity, right? So if you had to rely on building these proteins de novo, it wouldn't correspond to the body's need whatsoever. So when you have GLUT4 transporters in an endosome, it can respond very rapidly to changes in glucose concentration outside the cell. Okay, so this is really a nice way. So these GLUT4 transporters, actually you could maybe even consider these GLUT4 transporters when they're in the endosome as a GLUT4ogen, right? They're kind of inactive. They're not really doing anything. How do we activate a GLUT4ogen? We insert the endosome into the plasma membrane, and now they have activity. And that happens as a result of this insulin molecule activating this tyrosine kinase, which changes the activity of enzymes inside the cytoplasm. Okay, so you should know that what is the abnormality called where you can't regulate blood glucose? That's diabetes. And you know of two different kinds of diabetes, I think, from lab. There's type 1 and type 2. And what does type 1 do to? Maybe autoimmune disease, but functionally, what's happening? How can we treat somebody with diabetes type 1? okay insulin. Somebody with diabetes type 1 is not making this signaling molecule right here. Okay? And if this molecule isn't being made, then this tyrosine kinase is just sitting there watching forever to do something and never sees a signal. So these GLUT4 transporters are never inserted into the membrane, and glucose can never enter the cell, and so blood glucose is high forever. Okay? Okay. So type 1 is due to the non-production of insulin. Type 2, you have normal levels of insulin, but still something isn't working. What is not working? Yeah, so we think it's this tyrosine kinase receptor for some reason is not working properly. Or maybe the receptor is working, but maybe some of this metabolism in here that's controlling the insertion of these endosomes is not working properly, right? So that is still, and maybe there are 20 different kinds of diabetes type 2 mellitus, right? Depending on what stage of this process that's being affected. So that's all ongoing research. So that's all pretty interesting. Okay, so type 1, type 2 diabetes. One is due to you're not making insulin. Type 2 is because there's something wrong with the receptor or the receptor system here controlling the insertion of these endosomes. Now, here is something that's particularly powerful that's not on this slide. It should be on this slide. There is another process that can insert these GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane. What is the first thing that we learned about? What's the first thing that inserts, that controls or stimulates the insertion of these GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane? What's the signal? Insulin. Right? Okay. There is another signal that takes these transporters from an endosome, puts them into the cell membrane, and when they're in the cell membrane, the cell can take up glucose, decreasing blood glucose, and then this glucose can feed the cell so it can have a normal life. The second signal for insertion is, in muscle anyway, is exercise. Ooh. Okay. You hate to hear that, but actually that's a really good thing, right? All right, so two things somebody with diabetes can do, okay, if they're type 1, they can take insulin, but if they're type 2, there's something that they can use to help themselves out, and that is exercise, okay, plus diet, because you don't want to overdose on glucose, that's for sure, okay? So exercise. Exercise does the same thing as insulin, okay? And so somebody with type 2, right? So that's why we think it's the receptor here that's not operating properly in somebody with type 2 and not some of this other mechanism here, because exercise still works, at least for probably the major kinds of people that I'm aware of. Right? Maybe exercise doesn't work for some people, but so that's why we think it's the tyrosine kinase receptor. Okay, so that's a little bit about insulin and that GLUT4 transporter. So I think you should be impressed with that system. That's pretty nifty how that all works. Okay. If you don't see it, go back, study it over the weekend. Okay, pituitary gland. The pituitary is located underneath the hypothalamus at the base of the forebrain, and that's in the cella turcica of the sphenoid bone. And the pituitary gland has basically two parts to it. There's a posterior pituitary and an anterior pituitary here. The posterior pituitary is nervous tissue. It's made up of axons, and the anterior part is glandular tissue, two totally different kinds of things. Okay. And nonetheless, the pituitary releases some hormones. The posterior pituitary releases oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone, and the anterior pituitary releases a list that I'll show you in just a second. I don't want to tell you because you're going to be busy writing them all down, and you don't have to write them all down. Okay, but the release of hormones from the pituitary gland is controlled by the hypothalamus. So I want to talk a little bit about the control of the pituitary by the hypothalamus. And I suppose one place I could start is by saying that there's another name for the pituitary gland. Does anybody know another? It's kind of a strange name.
Hypophysis.
Yeah, hypophysis. Right, that means below the hypothalamus. All right, so here, this is the hypophysis or the pituitary gland. You got an anterior part and a posterior part. All right, so the release of hormones from the anterior pituitary is controlled by other hormones that are released in the hypothalamus. The hormones that are released in the hypothalamus are called releasing hormones or releasing factors, RFs or sometimes RHs. And they're hormones because how is a hormone transported in the body? Via a duct or not a duct? No duct, just by the circulatory system. All right, so these releasing factors are released by neurons in the hypothalamus. They're picked up by what sort of a blood vessel can absorb stuff? It's got to be a capillary, right? So here's the first capillary bed. And then these capillaries coalesce into a vessel that goes through the infundibulum. Sometimes we call that the pituitary stalk. And sometimes I kind of make fun of this a little bit. Did I ever say in here what this is? A good way to remember what this is. All right, it contains tracts as well as these blood vessels. What is the part of the central nervous system that is a major conduit, carries millions of tracts to major parts of the brain, like from the pons to the cerebellum? There are three huge bridges that go from the pons back to the cerebellum. And then there's a huge bridge that goes from the brainstem up to the cerebrum. We call those peduncles. Okay, that's a peduncle. Okay, so you have the cerebellar peduncles that go to the cerebellum. You've got the cerebral peduncles that go to the cerebrum. And so to me, this kind of looks like a peduncle right here. But it's what kind of peduncle? How big is the pituitary? Pituitary is small, and this infundibulum is even smaller. So I call that a peduncolito. Right there. Okay, it's just a very small peduncle. All right, but it's a pathway. All right, so hormones are releasing factors from the hypothalamus are carried by this blood vessel. Right, this is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel, which takes that hormone to the glandular tissue of the anterior pituitary. And since there are capillaries here, that hormone, the releasing hormone, can diffuse out. And it can bind to receptors in the anterior pituitary, and when it does, it's going to change the metabolism of these cells, causing release of other hormones into the circulation. Okay, so what kind of circulatory system is this right here? What is the usual kind of circulatory system? You have heart. What leaves the heart? What's the name of a blood vessel leaving the heart? Artery, right? Artery, and an artery goes to a capillary bed. All right, so here's a capillary, and it returns to the heart. What's that called? That's a vein, right? Substances can't enter an artery because they're way too thick. They have elastic tissue, muscle tissue, right? Because so they don't blow up when it's high pressure. And veins have three big layers. Things can't enter or leave a vein, but a capillary only has an endothelium. So capillaries specialize for exchange. This is the usual kind of circulatory pattern that you see for the pulmonary circulation as well as the systemic circulation. But in a few places in the body, we don't see that situation. We see the following architecture. We see the heart. Here is an artery going to a capillary bed right here. Exchange takes place. Then another blood vessel, and guess what we got here? We got capillary bed number one, capillary bed number two. This is what? This is an artery. This is a vein. And what do we call this vessel right here? From anatomy. Think anatomy. You're right. This is a portal vein. Portal vein. So where maybe you ran into a portal vein is that here is, for instance, a mesenteric artery supplying capillaries, stomach, intestines, for instance, but that venous blood doesn't go right back to the circulation. It's detoxified in the liver first. So it goes back via the hepatic portal vein to the liver where it's detoxified, and then it goes back to the inferior vena cava. So this is what we call a portal system. Two capillary beds back to back before it gets to the heart, as opposed to this circumstance here. So this right here is another special portal system. A portal system is a special delivery system that brings materials from one part of the body directly to another part of the body without going through the whole systemic circulation. And this one right here is called the hypophyseal No, hypothalamo from the hypothalamus to the hypophysis portal system, which takes these releasing factors directly to the anterior pituitary gland. And maybe over the weekend you want to read up a little bit about this, because Tuesday we're going to talk about, it's not really confusing, but the more you see it, the easier it's going to be to listen to it in lecture. Okay, so so this is neuronal tissue, this is glandular tissue, and whenever you hear this term, you might want to see this in your book, adeno. When you ever see that term, adeno, like adenocarcinoma, for instance, what's the basis of that tumor? Like sarcoma is muscle, right? Adeno is going to be a tumor derived from some kind of glandular tissue someplace. Right, so sometimes we call this the adeno hypothesis because it's the glandular part of the pituitary gland. I don't know if it's not on this slide. It's on one of your slides. So is that it for today? Or pretty close? Oh, we got a couple minutes. My watch is fast. All right, so don't forget the peduncolito right here. No, no one in the world has ever called it that. I mean, it's a perfect name. It should be called that. Yeah, peduncolito, perfect. I mean, that's better. That's as good as infundibulum. Okay? Okay. All right, so let's see. I think we talked about this slide already. The hypophysis is broken up into what? The adenohypophysis, the glandular part, versus the neurohypophysis. Right here, and here's the infundibulum, which contains the portal vessel as well as tracts. There are tracts that go from the hypothalamus into the posterior lobe, and then the portal system goes from the hypothalamus into the anterior lobe. Okay. All right, well, let's look at the posterior lobe for just a second. There are two nuclei in the hypothalamus, namely the paraventricular nucleus and the supraoptic nucleus. These are sensitive to things that are happening within the central nervous system. I'll give you some examples of this maybe a little bit later on. And ADH and oxytocin are synthesized in these locations and then translocated down this tract. So this is what, a bunch of axons, they're myelinated, but it's carrying by axoplasmic flow these signaling molecules. So we call this the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract going through the infundibulum. And when these cells are stimulated with a neurotransmitter that sets up an action potential, goes down through the infundibulum, when the action potential reaches the axon terminus right here, that's going to cause release of ADH or oxytocin. And there's a nice capillary bed right here, and ADH and oxytocin are transported everywhere in the body. All right, so here you have a neuron releasing a signaling molecule into the blood. It's not going through a duct. So what would you like to call these? What would you like to call ADH and oxytocin? Would you like to call these a neurotransmitter because they're released by a neuron? Or would you like to call this a hormone because they're released into the circulatory system? Okay. And you know what? You could probably have a discussion for the next 100 years whether it's really a neurotransmitter. Some people say, well, it's a neurotransmitter because it's released by a neuron, right? And then you could say just as effectively, well, obviously not. It's a hormone because it's picked up by the blood. So probably the best thing to say is that ADH and oxytocin are neurohormones because they're released by neurons, but they're picked up by the circulatory system. Okay, let's just talk about what their action is briefly. Oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant, will cause smooth muscle to contract. Very important during two processes.
So
first, okay, I'm sorry, who?
The contraction?
Yes.
Contraction for giving birth.
Yeah, parturition, right? Expulsion of the fetus from the uterus. Very important, very powerful contractions. Another contraction of smooth muscle, very necessary too. Maybe not so much these days, but certainly used to be. It's responsible for the milk letdown reflex when a baby is nursing. It causes contraction of the glandular tissue of the breast to secrete milk. Okay, so it's important for the milk letdown reflex. So, for instance, when an infant is nursing, then the mother feels that stimulation on the breast. That stimulation is carried by nerves to the brain, and the brain signals these nerves in the hypothalamus to release oxytocin, which then travels by the blood to the breast, which then causes milk letdown. And so the infant then starts to feed. And how does an infant nurse when there is milk on the breast? Kind of like lackadaisical, or is excited about it? Yeah, they're excited about it. So what do? They nurse more, which does what? Stimulates the mother's reflex even more, which produces more oxytocin, which produces more milk, which is what? A positive feedback cycle. So here is an example of a normal positive feedback cycle, but how come the infant doesn't feed and drink milk and drink milk and then all of a sudden explode because they've drunk milk? And how come the whole world isn't filled up with milk? Because positive feedback means what? Things are always escalating. Okay, how do you stop a positive feedback cycle? Something has to stop. And what happens? Well, the breast only has a finite limit to how much milk is produced by it, right, and stored. And so when the breast runs out of milk, what happens to the infant? Kind of gets bored, stops nursing, and everybody kind of goes back to their normal everyday life. Okay. Antidiuretic hormone, on the other hand, well, what does a diuretic do? A diuretic makes you pee, right? Puts you into a state of diuresis. Antidiuretic hormone does what? Makes you retain water. It's the opposite of what a diuretic does. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone is very important for maintaining water balance in a person. And for instance, if there's a pituitary tumor right here, and antidiuretic hormone is not being released, What is that person doing all the time? They're urinating all the time, right? Yeah, they're urinating all the time. And if you're urinating all the time, you're going to have that sensation of thirst. So what are you doing besides urinating? You got to be drinking or you're going to turn into a potato chip, right? So abnormal decreased levels of ADH produce drinking water all the time. And for instance, I've had a couple students that are walking around with a gallon jug of water all the time. And I would always ask them, why do you have like this aquarium with you and you're drinking from, why not just a regular little bottle? And I say, do you drink like a gallon a day? Which I think probably would be a lot of water to drink, okay? Because I'm thinking of, well, maybe they have a deficiency of antidiuretic hormone and they're just losing that water as soon as they drink it. And they say, well, you know, if you buy water, it's too expensive, and if you get water out of the pipes, it's toxic, so I just bring it from home, and I just bring a gallon with me. And I go, okay, well, that doesn't sound bad. Okay, but if someone is not making antidiuretic hormone that puts them into diuresis, what's another condition that you've learned about that produces that diuresis, where somebody's going to the bathroom all the time? As a matter of fact, we mentioned it today. Diabetes. What kind of diabetes? We call it diabetes mellitus, when you have a sugar imbalance, because when you have a lot of sugar in your blood that exceeds the renal threshold, it's excreted in the urine, and you should never lose glucose in the urine. But when glucose is in the urine, it pulls water into the urine, and then you have to avoid that from your body. Okay, so diabetes is characterized by that excessive urination. But look, when you don't have antidiuretic hormone, it produces the same kind of effect. Right, so we call that diabetes as well, but it's a different kind of diabetes. We call that diabetes insipidus. Diabetes insipidus versus diabetes mellitus. Diabetes insipidus is due to inability of your body to produce ADH. Diabetes mellitus is due to what? Glucose metabolism, not being able to uptake glucose from cells. And that's really easy. A lot of teachers are taught to diagnose that condition because if you have a student in third grade, they have diabetes insipidus, what are they doing all the time? They're raising their hand, and what are they saying? Can I go to the bathroom? 10 minutes later, can I go to the bathroom? And what else are they doing? Drinking all the time or eating ice cubes. Right? So it's usually diagnosed pretty early in somebody's life, diabetes insipidus. All right, so next time I guess we're going to start here. We're going to maybe start here. Look at some of these hormones, all right, from the anterior pituitary. Or adeno hypothesis. Don't forget, no school on Monday.
Oh.
Yeah, too bad. Tuesday there's school. Oh yeah, Yeah, we celebrate it on Monday. So we do meet on Tuesday. I'm glad I mentioned that then. So yeah, please come to school Tuesday. But if